James Beard Foundation Book Award winner Andrew Coe discusses his book, A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression. Culinary history scholar and author Andrew Coe's New Cultural History, A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression, is an in-depth exploration of the greatest food crisis the nation has ever faced and how it transformed America's culinary culture. The book was co-authored with Jane Ziegelman and was awarded the 2017 James Beard Foundation Book Award for Nonfiction.
Thank you all for coming. When we did the chapter on Michigan, I did not know that I would be coming to Michigan, so it's great to be here. My wife and I are culinary historians. We write about people eating. But when we started this project, we realized that it would be unlike any other culinary history that we've written. The story of people not eating would be just as important. The issues of hunger, malnutrition, and even starvation are central to the storyline of the Great Depression. This was the era when Americans for the first time vigorously debated questions such as, should we feed the hungry? And if so, what should we give them? And the larger question of, what is a healthy diet? We still haven't resolved these questions today. Indeed, at a time when the future of anti-hunger programs is in doubt, it's particularly important to look back to the lessons of the Great Depression. Before 1929, Americans had never suffered widespread famine. We were blessed by vast expanses of rich soil tilled by the most productive farmers on earth. When we thought of hunger, we thought of World War I, Russia during the Revolution, and starving children in China. Between 1922 and 1929, the United States underwent an unprecedented expansion. Cities boomed. Henry Ford sold millions of Model T cars, and the idea that Americans could go hungry was, well, unimaginable. In 1928, we elected as president a dynamic engineer named Herbert Hoover, who had been President Coolidge's Secretary of Commerce. He first became famous for his skills as a disaster relief expert. He was the man who fed starving Belgians and French during World War I. And who kept thousands of Americans alive with food and shelter in the aftermath of the 1927 Mississippi flood. This is a tent city built on a levee along the Mississippi River during that flood. Voters saw him as the most capable man in the nation, if not the world. They were sure that if any problem arose, Hoover would be able to fix it. 7 months after Hoover's inauguration, the stock market crashed. This was seen on Wall Street in the autumn of 1929 after one of the big downturns in the market. Like many, Hoover believed the downturn would be brief, lasting maybe a few months. The American economy was fundamentally strong, he said. People just needed to stop being pessimistic and start investing again. That was an inadequate solution to the problem. Early in 1930, the economy fell into a deflationary spiral. As business profits dropped, many companies fired workers to reduce costs. The ripple effects were felt in nearly every corner of American society, including on the nation's dinner tables. Even though food prices were dropping, wages were falling more quickly. So families suddenly couldn't afford a square meal. That, in the context of America in 1930, still meant meat and potatoes, bread and butter, maybe a vegetable or pickles, coffee and pie or cake for dessert. The first outward sign of the food crisis was the New York City breadline. In March of 1930, the pastor of a church just off Fifth Avenue noticed an increase of homeless men in the neighborhood and began handing out meal tickets good at a nearby greasy spoon. Within a few weeks, a line of men 6 wide wrapped around the block, while dozens of other bread lines popped up across Manhattan. Journalists reporting on those lines were shocked to notice that they contained not only the usual bums and loafers, but suddenly unemployed office workers dressed in their best suits and ties. This was one way that families survived sudden hard times. Fathers ate on the bread lines, while mothers fed their children with cheap and filling foods like beans, fried potatoes, and watery stew with hunks of day-old bread to mop the bowls clean. Out in rural America, the first region to feel the food crisis was the Cotton Belt, stretching from southern Virginia to Texas. In mid-1930, this region was hit by a terrible drought that destroyed crops and killed livestock. Big city journalists who traveled to cotton country were shocked at the poverty and hunger they discovered there. Even before the drought, southern sharecroppers and tenant farmers lived on the traditional foods of poverty, the same diet that had sustained slaves before emancipation. The staples were salt pork and cornbread seasoned with molasses. This was supplemented with rice and beans, greens and sweet potatoes, and whatever they could hunt or fish. And one of the main cooking mediums was lard. And you can see that these buckets here are, it says American Sunrise, pure lard. These are lard buckets, which they're, you know, using again for other means. But this was a central part of the diet. After the drought killed these crops, the larders of their shotgun shacks emptied out. Children grew gaunt, and both young and old began to show signs of pellagra and rickets, malnutrition diseases that had long plagued the region. By the second half of 1930, it was clear that hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of Americans, were going hungry. This was what a homeless encampment, which was dubbed a Hooverville after our president, on the west side of Highway, where Riverside Drive is today. Actually, we're below where Riverside Drive is, where the West Side Highway is today. Those are the big apartment buildings on Riverside Drive you can see on the right. The question was, who would help them and how? During that era, the social safety net was mostly non-existent. For the unemployed, there was also a huge stigma, a feeling of shame and failure attached to being forced to ask the local government for food. They turned first to family and friends, then to local churches and charity organizations. Some towns and cities, particularly New York City, cobbled together makeshift organizations to hand out food relief. This is the New York City government's first big food relief effort, and the point men for the food relief were the New York City Police Department. Here is seen handing out food. And one of the things about this was, one of the notable things about this, you know, you see from this picture, is that it was in public, that they were handing out food on the street. And I talked about the shame that people felt on accepting the food. If you're accepting the food before, you know, in full view of everybody on the street and your neighbors, they know that you're not, you know, that you're not being able to, you know, support yourself. So this sort of exacerbated that feeling. But none of these efforts met the need, because this was unlike any other economic crisis in American history. From 1930 to 1932, the unemployment rate rose from 10% to 25%, the highest it has ever been. The streets of every city and town teem with idle, worn-out men trying to bum the price of a cup of coffee and a donut. But perversely, as the human tragedy increased, many institutions and individuals, including President Hoover himself, found reasons not to help the hungry. Here's how he justified blocking federal relief during the bleakest period of the Depression. My own conviction is strongly that if we break down this sense of responsibility, of individual generosity to individual, and mutual self-help in this country in times of national difficulty, and if we start appropriations of this character, we have not only impaired something infinitely valuable in the life of the American people, but have struck at the roots of government. And things weren't that bad, he insisted. After all, no one has starved. Hoover was wrong. In New York City alone, 20 people died of starvation in 1931, and another 95 were admitted to hospitals near death from lack of food, but had been saved. Starvation probably killed thousands of Americans during the Depression decade, while many more suffered and even died from malnutrition diseases. This is a picture of a young girl who's part of a migrant farm worker's family somewhere in the Midwest. And this is how malnutrition affects people, affected people at the time. Migrant farm workers couldn't always get enough food. So the old and the young would become weakened from malnutrition and more susceptible to diseases. And of course, they didn't have money and they didn't have access to medical care. So when somebody got sick, they would just simply stop by the side of the road and wait. And either they got better or they didn't. There's no evidence on what happened to this young girl, but that's the situation we see here. The American people saw the divide between their lives and the political rhetoric coming from Washington and wanted change. They found it in a candidate who said that that this nation owes a positive duty that no one shall be permitted to starve, and promised that if charities and local governments couldn't feed the hungry, the federal government would step into the breach. Roosevelt won the 1932 elections by a landslide and quickly began reshaping Washington. His main vehicle for feeding the hungry unemployed was FERA, the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, led by Harry Hopkins, a New York social worker who would later become Roosevelt's chief aide. The ink was barely dry on the FERA Act before Hopkins began signing checks sending money to the states. State and local governments would distribute this relief, but all of it would be closely regulated by FERA officials back in Washington. Every week, FERA clients received pink vouchers listing the foods which they could receive. Voucher in hand, they went to the local grocery store, where the grocer filled the food order and then would be reimbursed by the local relief agency. Formulated based on the cutting edge of nutritional knowledge at the time, the relief order was designed to give the unemployed just the irreducible minimum of nutrients. In other words, it was only meant to sustain health for a short amount of time. This meant mostly flour, milk, bread, and potatoes. Aside from salt, no seasoning such as vinegar or mustard was allowed. The thinking was that if the food was too flavorful, relief clients would become satisfied and less likely to look for work. In the fall of 1933, the unemployed received a welcome boost to this meager relief menu. The United States Department of Agriculture decided to tackle the perennial problem of farm overproduction by buying up surplus produce. At first, they simply destroyed the crops, but bad publicity over thousands of pigs being slaughtered while millions of Americans went hungry was so negative that Roosevelt changed course. The Federal Surplus Relief Corporation, also headed by Harry Hopkins, was founded to distribute foods to FERA clients, beginning with 6-pound blocks of salt pork, as this is one of those blocks of salt pork, along with a handy sheet of recipes from the Bureau of Home Economics. This is a copy of the actual sheet, How to Cook Salt Pork. It says on top, salt pork is an all-around meat. You can serve it fried with milk gravy or with cereals and vegetables in one-dish meals or in sandwiches and many other savory ways. And actually, we didn't have a recipe for it in the book, but we saw it a number of times, is that salt pork was considered one of the great Midwestern farmhouse foods. And fried salt pork with milk gravy was considered a little bit of heaven for people who had grown up on the farms. This was considered one of the great foods. So maybe some people in this room, maybe some of their parents or grandparents prepared that. And below it, you see the recipes. And these recipes illustrate a problem faced by relief workers. On the one hand, they knew that rural Americans loved salt pork, and that salt pork was a pillar of a diet that could cause pellagra and other deficiency diseases that they were trying to combat. Yet now they were handing out big chunks of the stuff to every hungry citizen. The point of these recipes was to teach the unemployed how to use salt pork in a way that wouldn't kill them. Each one of these recipes combines salt pork with ingredients like canned tomatoes, dried beans, and wheat germ, and most importantly, milk, in order to improve their nutritional profile. You have recipes, if you can't read that, like salt pork with dried beans or peas, and also below that, a salt pork vegetable chowder. Not exactly a vegetarian dish, but one of the, it's salt pork with potatoes and chopped root vegetables. And sometimes below, they also added wheat germ. They love having wheat germ, salt, pork, and vegetables all mashed together in a dish. Other foods soon entered the relief pipeline, though clients were never sure from one week to the next what their boxes would contain. This is a relief box, and from the right you can see canned tomatoes, a bag of coffee, the silvery can there is some kind of vegetable shortening, evaporated milk in those cans there, and then the two bags, different bags on the left, are probably, one is white flour, the other one is probably cornmeal. One of the staples of these relief boxes was canned beef that had been slaughtered and preserved in FARA-administered factories. It must have had an interesting taste. The cattle were from herds that were slowly dying in the drought-stricken plains, and it had been purchased by the government to help ranchers. Unemployed Americans did not complain. Federal food handouts kept them from suffering malnutrition and even starvation for 2.5 years. Then, at the end of 1935, President Roosevelt abruptly brought them to an end. Harry Hopkins had been keeping a close eye on the morale of the unemployed across the nation. After the initial elation over receiving relief boxes died down, the unemployed now displayed an alarming condition, vaguely defined as dependency. That is, many had stopped looking for work and were now content to simply stay at home and live off relief. There was also a political calculation involved. Roosevelt needed to deflect conservative pushback against New Deal programs and improve his chances for the impending 1936 election. In his 1935 State of the Union address, the president announced the end of food handouts, declaring that continued dependence on relief induces a spiritual and moral disintegration fundamentally destructive to the national fiber. It is in violation of the traditions of America. Herbert Hoover would have been comfortable with those words. And ironically, they brought on another period of hunger and malnutrition that harkened back to the worst days of the early 1930s. FDR was gambling that the economy would continue its slow recovery. The unemployment rate had declined to 15%, while business was picking up. In fact, Roosevelt was so optimistic that he also ordered wide cuts in federal spending. Unfortunately, it turned out that the government spending had floated the recovery, and thus began 3 years of what was called the Roosevelt Recession. As businesses slashed payrolls, bread lines reappeared in cities like Chicago and Cleveland. This is Cleveland, Ohio, in probably 1938 or 1939. The city government, all it has to hand out to the poor unemployed are potatoes, and they don't even have boxes to hand out the potatoes. So the unemployed families are lining up in the background there, and they have boxes, carts, and baby carriages with which they are going to cart away their ration of potatoes. Aside from New York State and a few others, most communities were loath to make up the deficit in federal relief spending. Men scrounged on garbage dumps, while families tried to figure out how to survive on meager and irregular handouts of flour, potatoes, and occasionally fresh fruit. Hundreds of thousands of Americans showed signs of malnutrition disorders during these years, and some, particularly young children, did starve to death. The president was very aware of the dire situation. However, he had decided what they needed was not food, but jobs. He would help them through the new Works Progress Administration, which embarked on a massive public works program. Unfortunately, WPA wages were low, not enough for a family of four to live on, and the number of jobs never enough. Bit by bit, Roosevelt and Hopkins grudgingly reopened the pipeline of federal food relief. First, they increased spending for the WPA's school lunch program. That they could justify because it gave jobs to women. Then in 1939, the federal government started the food stamp program. This is a family receiving the first food for food stamps in Los Angeles. That was acceptable because farmers were again producing more than the market could absorb. So the USDA bought their excess butter, pork, beans, and the like, and gave them to the unemployed and to hungry WPA workers. The Roosevelt administration certainly would have been forced to do more, but it was saved from further compromising its principles by the outbreak of the European War. As part of a massive rearmament plan, Roosevelt built vast weapons plants on both coasts and in the industrial heartland. The economy boomed while the unemployment rate dropped below 10% by early 1941 and would fall to 2% in 1943. Old Man Depression was finally dead. But the memory of hunger, vividly depicted in those photographs of breadlines, of long lines of hollow-eyed men in shabby coats waiting for some watery stew and coffee, has remained with us ever since. The story of how these women came to power began several decades before the Depression, during the heyday of the Progressive Era, the same period that gave us reformers like Jacob Riis, Upton Sinclair, Susan B. Anthony, and all the various movements which they represented. It may surprise you, some of you, to hear that the home economics movement comes out of that same progressive worldview. Home economics, in its original incarnation, was a social reform movement started by women who believed that homemaking should be treated as a legitimate profession, on the same level as medicine or engineering. And like any profession, it required rigorous training. So instead of learning at home, girls would go to school and study the science of keeping house. They would take classes in chemistry, biology, bacteriology, and most importantly, nutrition. So when they became wives and mothers, they would know how to feed their families according to scientific standards. And that's one of the reasons why this home economics class has the look of a laboratory and why they're wearing white coats. The home economics attitude toward food grew out of the same culture that gave us the temperance movement. And there was, in fact, a lot of overlap between the temperance people and the home economics people. Here are two of the temperance people, leaders of the Women's Christian Temperance Union in New York City. Taking a page from their temperance sisters, home economists believed that pleasure while eating led to what they called food intemperance, a condition where they hoped to prevent by developing a style of cooking that avoided sensory stimulation. Home economists used only mild flavors, no garlic, no spices, no condiments. They avoided superfluous variety and kept away from overly rich ingredients. In other words, their cooking was built on the core American values of thrift and self-discipline. At the start of the 20th century, nutrition was still in its infancy, but home economists were at the vanguard, following the latest discoveries and translating them into terms accessible to the public. Home economists lectured, opened cooking schools, and wrote cookbooks that introduced women to the idea of food groups, carbs, fats, and proteins, to the concept of calories, and eventually to the importance of vitamins and minerals. The public, however, was not particularly receptive, especially the working class, the home economists' target audience. But that would all change during the 1930s as the health effects of the Depression became more and more evident. One of the first places that happened was in New York. In the fall of 1930, New York public schools began to see unusual attendance patterns. More kids were missing school and for longer periods than in other years, and no one knew why. Truant officers were sent out to investigate and drag these AWOL kids back to their classrooms. But what they discovered were children too weak from hunger to leave the house. Mothers watched while their kids lost weight and grew listless. And as resistance went down, rates of illness went up. Mothers who once had no reason to worry about their children's diet now felt that knowledge of things like vitamins and minerals and calories was critical to their well-being. Getting enough protein into their children's diet had never been a problem in the past, but it was now. And women needed to know which foods gave them the most protein for their money. They wanted to know what foods contained calcium and vitamins A and C, and what were the signs of vitamin deficiency, how to keep from destroying vitamins during cooking, and the list goes on. The government agency responsible for answering their questions was the Federal Bureau of Home Economics, a female-dominated branch of the Department of Agriculture that functioned as a kind of homemaking research center and advisor to the public on best housekeeping practices. This is Louise Stanley, the head of the Bureau of Home Economics from 1923 or 1924 into World War II. She was a very impressive figure, very important. She was one of the most powerful women in Washington during that time. She had a chemistry degree from Yale University, a PhD in chemistry. And under her, the Bureau became like one of the primary places, one of the few places, where women who had advanced science degrees could get jobs which reflected their education. Because there was lots of sexism in universities at that time, and they didn't believe that women had male professors didn't believe that women had a place. The Bureau was founded in 1924, but during the Depression, as fears about malnutrition intensified, it recognized a unique teaching opportunity. In 1931, as letters from desperate homemakers began streaming in, the Bureau put its regular research on hold and launched a national educational campaign to inform Americans about the fundamentals of modern nutrition. This is one of the brochures which they distributed very, very widely, The Family's Food at Low Cost. And it's written by Hazel Stiebling, who went on to become the leader of the Bureau of Home Economics. And below her, Miriam Birdseye. And if you know, if that rings a bell, she was actually the older sister of Clarence Birdseye, the inventor of Birdseye frozen foods. And she was actually the reason why Clarence became interested in food to begin with. He saw, was aware that she was taking home economics classes as a kid. And he became fascinated with it, and he actually started taking home ec classes as well, and that sparked his interest in food. I don't know if you can read it, but it starts, "Spend your money wisely is always good advice." It's talking about how to feed your family good, healthy food for a little money. At the heart of their message you had what they called the protective foods, food like fruits and vegetables and milk that were high in vitamins and minerals and therefore protected the body from deficiency diseases like scurvy, rickets, and pellagra. Up to this point, all the Bureau could give to hungry Americans were pamphlets like these containing their recommendations. After Roosevelt was elected, however, the power and influence of this small group of government home economists increased exponentially. They now formulated guidelines for the relief agencies giving food to millions of unemployed Americans. The basic rules for this work were set forth in a Bureau publication called Diets at Four Levels of Nutritive Content and Cost, also, as you can see, by Hazel Stiebling. It broke down their recommendations for the ideal American diet down into four categories based on income level: liberal, adequate at moderate cost, adequate at minimum cost, and restricted for emergency use. And it's probably too small for you to read, but I'll just give you the broad picture. People who were able to enjoy the liberal diet had a lot of lean meat, fish, and eggs, about 20% of their diet, while people who were fed the restricted diet for emergency use only had about 5% of their diet as lean meat, fish, and eggs, and most of their diet was actually made up of bread, flour, and cereals. And the restricted diet for emergency use, it turns out, was what the Bureau decided to give to the unemployed. This meant mostly grains, bread, biscuits, and cornbread, dairy products, some vegetables, and very little meat or eggs. And here is what they say about restricted diets for emergency use. This diet is not considered adequate for use over an indefinite period. It goes on to say, but this diet was actually given to the hungry, poor, unemployed for an indefinite period because the Depression kept going on and on. The Relief Administration was also under tremendous pressure to keep costs down and, as I noted earlier, prevent people from becoming too fat and comfortable on government food. Home economists warn relief clients that they might continue to feel hungry and lose weight on the emergency diet. But they shouldn't worry about that hollow feeling they were feeding, because they were feeding the more important hidden hunger that was the body's need for vitamins and minerals. So you may be feeling hungry, you may be losing weight, you may be losing energy, but at least you're keeping your vitamin and mineral levels up, which was, I think, cold comfort. The task of applying these rules to the unemployed fell to local relief administrators, women like Louise Armstrong in the lumber town of Manistee, Michigan. This is Louise here wearing the hat with some of her younger relief clients. And Manistee, Michigan was a lumber town, which, like many communities in the United States during the 1920s, were in a depression but didn't really realize it, because they'd cut down all the trees around Manistee a decade or two before, and that was the basis for the local economy, and it never picked up. And like many communities across the nation during the so-called boom times of the Great Depression, of the 1920s, they had entered the Great Depression before the Depression. Louise Armstrong was a Chicago social worker, and her husband was a commercial artist from Chicago. They fled to Manistee after they lost their jobs, because Manistee was where they had a summer house. And this was actually a common thing for people to do living in cities. If they had a summer home, they figured that they could live more cheaply and grow some vegetables or other crops and ride out the Great Depression. After FDR's election, the state needed someone to run the new local relief program. And it turned out that Armstrong was the only one in the county with social work experience. She got the job. She had to build a relief apparatus from scratch, to interpret the complicated and constantly changing instructions from Washington, and to feed all the hungry people in town and across the county's isolated rural areas. Some of her clients broke down and cried when they were handed the first six-pound blocks of salt pork. They hadn't seen meat in months. Armstrong also began a community gardening program and taught canning skills to preserve produce for the long northern Michigan winters. Her work, 7 days a week and often 12 hours a day, lasted for almost 2 years, until President Roosevelt pulled the plug on direct relief and replaced it with the WPA. In Michigan and in the Manistee area, the federal food program was taken over by inept and often corrupt state administrators, while the number of hungry unemployed again began to rise. The women who ran the Bureau of Home Economics saw that it wasn't just the unemployed who needed to find nutritious foods. They also ran a wide-ranging effort to help American housewives shake off depression gloom and learn new and healthy ways to fill their family stomachs. Its main vehicle was the Bureau's national radio program, Housekeepers Chat, starring the fictional character of Aunt Sammy, a sort of Betty Crocker figure and spokeswoman for the federal government. And this is the first paragraph, top of the first page for one of the Aunt Sammy scripts. And one of the reasons why Aunt Sammy was so successful is because people thought it was a local show. The Bureau of Home Economics distributed these scripts to individual radio stations all across the country, hundreds of radio stations. So a local woman would read the script in the local accent. So people felt that it was a local show. And the text of the script was also done and written in a kind of down-home folksy way. This one begins, "I was talking the other day to the mother of three up-and-coming youngsters. It wasn't long before we got around to food, and she began asking me questions. She wanted to know what to serve the family when there's less rather than more to spend. She's hard put to it these days, she said, to keep meals appetizing and interesting." And so not only did they have, these were the intros, and of course they had recipes. An important part of Aunt Sammy's mission was to get women to cook with a low status budget ingredients that no one really liked too much. Food like cabbage and beans and turnips. And this is what she says. For example, the food specialist made a delicious whole wheat chowder of it to serve a family. And believe it or not, the total bill for the ingredients was under 15 cents. Into this chowder, they put diced carrots, salt pork, onion for seasoning, milk, and whole wheat cooked first in water to make it tender and bring out the good flavor of the grains. In her role as culinary cheerleader, Aunt Sammy opened her shows with rousing tributes to these second-class foods, and then would close with relevant recipes created by home economists that had very little to do with culinary folk tradition or traditional food pairings. Instead, their cooking was based on calculations that ensured balanced nutrition. As a result, many home economics dishes have a kind of disjointed quality. So, for example, here are some of her suggestions for how to use peanuts, a cheap source of protein. Cabbage and peanut salad with boiled dressing. Scalloped onions and ground peanuts baked with white sauce. Banana rolled in mayonnaise, then rolled in peanuts, served on lettuce leaves. Information from the Bureau flowed through many channels. In addition to Aunt Sammy, there were newspapers, magazine, and government pamphlets. But no one person did more to promote the Bureau's work than Eleanor Roosevelt. Like other progressive women of her generation, Eleanor saw in home economics deliverance from the drudgery of housekeeping. But if home economics was good for women, it was also good for America, starting with the fundamental building block of American society, the family. This is Eleanor Roosevelt with a guest of honor at a meal celebrating the Housekeeper of the Year, and this woman here sitting to her right is the Housekeeper of the Year. And I'm sure they're eating some healthy, nutritious, budget dish there. In the midst of a national crisis, the woman who adopted a scientific diet guarded her family's health, and by extension, that of the nation when it was most at risk. To eat scientifically was therefore an act of patriotism. To inspire women and set an example for the rest of the country, as the new First Lady, Eleanor pledged to bring scientific cooking into the White House. And that's exactly what she did, using her husband as guinea pig. Early in 1933, just 2 weeks into the new administration, Eleanor, with great fanfare, served the president a lunch of deviled eggs with tomato sauce, a side of mashed potatoes, and for dessert, prune pudding. When asked what he thought of the meal, he answered, "It was good." But we know from White House memos that FDR, an enthusiastic gourmet, was deeply unhappy with Eleanor's budget menus. Lucky for Eleanor, she was someone who didn't really care about the experience of eating. Unlike her husband, Eleanor's approach to food was utilitarian. And this was her. This is the woman who executed Eleanor's orders for the White House foods. The White House housekeeper for the entire time of the Roosevelt administration, a woman named Henrietta Nesbitt. And Henrietta Nesbitt didn't actually prepare the food herself, but she certainly oversaw everything that was done in the kitchen. And this was a time when every food historian agrees that the worst food was probably ever served in the White House. And this is the woman. So Eleanor's approach to food was utilitarian. Food was a way of delivering necessary nutrients. And all utilitarian foods like beans and liver serve that purpose as well as roast beef and lamb chops, which are, of course, some of FDR's favorite foods. The Depression's consummate utility food, however, was a line of fortified breakfast cereals developed by home economists at Cornell University in 1932. And this is the two women who led the Cornell Home Economics Department, Flora Rose and Martha Van Rensselaer, who were great friends of the Roosevelts. Milkwito, Milkcorno, and Milkoto, made from grain and dried skim milk, represented the pinnacle of scientific eating. Forerunners to protein shakes and energy bars, they were foods engineered in the laboratory that were high in nutrients and non-perishable. They could be eaten alone, but with no defining flavor. They could also be added to other foods, including baked goods, soups, and sauces as a kind of nutritional enhancer. And the home economists were immensely creative in finding new ways to serve these dishes. And we have in our book, we include a recipe for milkweedo chop suey. And as Jan told you, I wrote a book called Chop Suey, A Cultural Food, A History of Chinese Food in the United States. And there is no way that anybody raised in, you know, real traditional Chinese food culture could recognize this dish as chop suey. But that didn't matter as long as it was nutritious. When we say that the Depression changed the way America eats, a big part of that was a shift in perspective. The idea that foods could be evaluated according to their chemical composition and that our food choices should be guided by science marked the beginning of a truly modern food sensibility. At the same time, looking at food through the lens of science helped us navigate our old nervousness about food and pleasure. Home economics gave us a way to think about food that avoided any reference to the sensory enjoyment of eating, but focused instead on what food could do for our bones and our muscles and our digestive systems, how food could make us stronger and more impervious to disease. So the next time you're in the supermarket and find yourself reading nutritional labels, calculating which box of cereal is lower in calories and higher in fiber, you can think back to the women of the Great Depression, the home economists who worked so hard to enlighten us. Thank you.